So it's my pleasure to introduce Mustafa Sahin, who's going to tell us about a similar story in tuberous sclerosis and where things are continuing to move forward. Hopefully fewer challenges, but some of that is just about the reality of getting more data. More data brings more challenges in interpretation. So enjoy it.
Thank you, Jeremy. I want to also thank the organizers for inviting me. What I'd like to tell you about today is our efforts in both the lab and the clinic to address autism spectrum disorder associated with tuberous sclerosis. Let me first start by explaining why we chose tuberous sclerosis. First of all, half of the patients with tuberous sclerosis will go on to develop autism spectrum disorder. And very importantly, many of the patients with tuberous sclerosis will be diagnosed before birth or at the time of birth because of the cardiac lesions that these patients develop. So we can identify these patients very early in life. I would like to argue that the cellular pathways aberrant in TSC are beginning to be understood, not just from the work that's being done in neuroscience, but also from the work that's been going on in oncology, immunology, transplant medicine, etc. And very luckily, we have FDA-approved specific inhibitors of this TSC-related pathway, the mTOR pathway, that can be used or repurposed in preclinical and clinical trials to provide some proof of concept data. So the combination of these four factors really makes tuberous sclerosis a unique opportunity among the genetic causes of autism. What is tuberous sclerosis? It's an autosomal dominant genetic disorder. It causes benign tumors in the brain, eyes, skin, kidneys, and the heart. And it usually presents to child neurologists like myself because 90% of the patients will develop seizures sometime in their life. Many of the patients are affected by intellectual disability and autism. The incidence is thought to be about 1 in 6,000, 1 in 10,000 newborns, so about 50,000 people in the United States, about 1 million people worldwide are expected to be affected with this disease. The genes have been known for about two decades. TSC1, which encodes for Hamartin, and TSC2, which encodes for tuberin, have been identified about 20 years ago. It turns out that tuberous sclerosis is a disease of cell size dysregulation. As you can see on this epilepsy specimen taken from the brain of a patient with tuberous sclerosis, you see the presence of these giant cells, which are about 10 times the size of a normal neuron. And these giant cells are pathognomonic for tuberous sclerosis. And in fact, in any organism or in any cell in which TSC1 or TSC2 genes are deleted, you see enlargement of cell size. As seen here, this is a Drosophila eye. The fruit fly eye is bigger if you're missing the TSC1 gene. Omatidia that make up the eye are bigger compared to wild-type omatidia. The hair cells on the back of the fly are bigger if you're missing TSC1 or TSC2 genes. And the reason for that is a very well-conserved, evolutionarily conserved pathway called the mTOR pathway, which stands for mechanistic target of rapamycin. So the way the pathway works, and this has been shown by Liz and Jeremy earlier, there's a GTPase called REP, which turns on a kinase called mTOR, and those two, when they're active, turn on protein synthesis in the cell. What TSC1 and TSC2 proteins do is to put a brake on this protein synthesis machinery. So they keep protein synthesis within normal range in the cells. As you can imagine, if you're missing either TSC1 or TSC2, this pathway becomes hyperactive. You get too much protein synthesis and too much cell growth. Cells have actually taken advantage of this pathway in various ways. So growth factors such as insulin or BDNF activate protein synthesis by inhibiting TSC1 and TSC2. On the opposite side, energy level in the cell also regulates this pathway. When you break down your ATP to AMP, you activate AMP kinase, which activates the TSC1, TSC2 brakes on the mTOR pathway, so a starving cell doesn't continue to grow. One of the main advantages of this correlation or this interaction between TSC and mTOR, which was made by five different groups around the world in 2002, is that we know that there are very specific inhibitors of the kinase mTOR. These started with the molecule rapamycin, which gives the kinase its name, but since then we have several inhibitors made by various companies that can be used in preclinical and clinical trials. One of the first questions we asked in TSC was, what's the true incidence of autism in the TSC population? In retrospective studies, that ranges somewhere from 17% to 80%, depending on the cohort you are studying. So we collaborated with Patrick Bolton's group in the United Kingdom, who had studied infants born with TSC serially, starting from 2 years of age up to 5 years of age, using ADAS and ADI, as well as Mullins. And Shefali Jesty, when she was a resident at Boston Children's, collaborated with Patrick Bolton's group and analyzed the data. And what she showed was that, wow, very sensitive. What she showed that about half of the patients with tuberous sclerosis go on to develop autism spectrum disorder, and half of them are not going to be affected. One of the most common questions I get asked is that is autism and tuberous sclerosis different from autism in non-TSC? And in my clinic population, when I see a patient with autism, if I don't see their neurocutaneous stigmata that are suspicious of tuberous sclerosis, I really can't tell whether they have tuberous sclerosis or not. But that's sort of an anecdotal response. Luckily, Patrick Bolton's group did a much more sophisticated study and looked at the ADI profiles of patients affected with autism with different genetic disorders, including tuberous sclerosis, and compared it to the ATI profile of patients in the AGRI sample. He did a principal component analysis and showed that the patients with tuberous sclerosis and autism actually looked very, very similar in the ADI profiles to those in the AGRI sample. So this argues that at least using this one criteria, that autism and tuberous sclerosis is very similar to what we see in the non-TSC population. Patrick's group also showed that cortical tubers, these benign lesions in the temporal lobes, are necessary but not sufficient for developing autism and tuberous sclerosis. Unfortunately, several other groups have looked at this correlation and have not found the same correlation. Some groups have implicated the cerebellum, other groups have implicated the frontal lobes. So I think this relationship between tubers and autism is still to be debated. In my experience, again, in the clinic, I can look at two MRIs from patients with tuberous sclerosis, and I cannot tell you which one is going to develop autism and which one is not going to develop autism. So here's a 17-year-old boy on the left. He has these three frontal lobe tubers. He's in an integrated class in high school, and he has mild learning disabilities. The girl on the right has approximately the same number and load of tubers. She is nonverbal and autistic. So looking at the conventional MRI is not very helpful from our perspective in predicting outcomes. So instead of focusing on those white spots, the tubers, we've decided to focus on the rest of the brain, the non-tuber pathology on tuberous sclerosis. And we've been doing a lot of diffusion tensor imaging, as I'll get to that toward the end of the talk. But as usual, the human study of the human patients affected with tuberous sclerosis is not going to give us a lot of insights into the mechanisms, unfortunately, that result in the behavioral abnormalities. So we've turned to mouse models, and for several years we've been studying mouse models of tuberous sclerosis in my lab with the hypothesis that TSC1, TSC2 regulate neural connectivity and function via mTOR. And we've focused on various aspects of neural development and function. Much of this is published, so I won't get into the details. But we've, for instance, published that TSC1, TSC2 proteins are important for determining the number of axons a cell, a neuron develops. We've also shown that in milder cases, in the haploinsufficient state, TSC1, TSC2 genes can regulate axon guidance. And more recently, a paper that just came out by Jonathan Lipton from my lab showed that TSC1, TSC2 mTOR pathway can interact with the pathway that regulates circadian rhythms in cells. So there might be a connection between the mTOR pathway and the circadian rhythm pathway. And this may have some implications for patients that are affected with tuberous sclerosis who have circadian rhythm abnormalities, for instance. But for the purpose of this talk, I want to focus on two findings that we've had, one on myelination, one on cerebellar circuitry. So the work on myelination started when we worked together with David Kiewiatkowski, who made a mouse model, a knockout of TSC1, only in the postmitotic neurons. And what we found was that these animals were born at the expected frequency, but they developed seizures around 3 weeks of life, and they died from seizures by 60 days of life. If you look at the brains of these mice, what was remarkable was that there was a reduction in the myelin basic protein staining, as shown in red here. On the top is the control mice, and as you can see, there's myelin deposition at 2 and 3 weeks of life in a normal development of the control mice. However, if you look at the mice that are missing the TSC1 gene in postmitotic neurons, there's a marked reduction in both the gray matter as well as the underlying white matter in terms of myelin basic protein staining. So we decided to ask, can we treat these mice with mTOR inhibitors? So we used two different mTOR inhibitors, both rapamycin and RAD001, which is also known as Afinitor. As I told you earlier, these mice, control mice that are treated with the vehicle, developed seizures, and they died from seizures by around 60 days of life. When we treated the knockout mice with rapamycin starting at P7, 90% of the mice survived as long as you kept them under treatment. And they did not display any seizures. If you stop the treatment at 30 days, the seizures developed around 60 days, and they started showing early mortality. And we saw essentially the same results with Afinitor. You may ask, what happens to myelination? This is the control brain, this is the mutant brain, and this is the mutant brain or rapamycin. A significant portion of the myelin basic protein staining comes back when you treat the mice with rapamycin. So we feel like the myelination and hypomyelination phenotype that we are seeing in TSC mice could be an interesting correlate of the behavioral abnormalities that we see in patients with tuberculosis. And myelination can also be a potential biomarker that we can study in patients with tuberculosis. A second story I'd like to briefly tell is a work that was done by Peter Tsai when he was in my lab, and that focuses on the circuitry. So what I'd like to argue here is that the genetic diseases such as tuberculosis can tell us not only about the biochemical pathways that are aberrant in relation to autism, but they can also provide us some insights into the neural circuitry underlying autism. What we decided to do was to delete TSC1 or TSC2 genes in different regions of the brain, in different cell types, and see what the effect of these deletions are on the behavioral phenotype of the mice. So the first one we studied and that had given us the most mileage is the cerebellum. Cerebellum has been implicated by various groups in executive function, autism, and other behavioral abnormalities. There is descriptive data from pathology specimens suggest that there is reduced Purkinje cell numbers in individuals affected with autism compared to non-individuals that are not affected with autism. There's abnormalities in the neuroimaging by MRI scans in the vermis volume and white matter in the cerebellum. But maybe more interestingly, there was a study by Kathleen Parapoulos at Boston Children's when she looked at newborns with isolated cerebellar hemorrhage and looked at the outcome of those children early in life, in 2 to 3 years of age. And she found that 37% of those children end up being diagnosed with subsequent autism spectrum disorder, especially with vermis involvement. So suggesting that isolated damage to the brain early in, isolated damage to the cerebellum early in development could significantly increase the risk of autism. So what we also know from the tuberculosis literature is that about a third of the patients with tuberculosis will have lesions in the in cerebellum. However, they may not show any signs by neurological examination. There are two papers, two different cohorts, suggesting that cerebellar lesions correlate with autism in patients with tuberculosis. And a study by Harry Shugani's group in Detroit did PET scanning on patients with tuberculosis with and without autism. And what he showed was that there was hypermetabolism in deep cerebellar nuclei in patients in TSC patients with autism, but not on those without autism. Now, just to remind you, cerebellar cortex inhibits the deep cerebellar nuclei, so hypermetabolism in deep cerebellar nuclei would implicate hypofunction of the cerebellar cortex. So with this background, the hypothesis that Peter set out to test was that could cerebellar dysfunction contribute to the pathogens of TSC? Not because all of the behavioral manifestations of autism that we were testing in the mice would come directly from the cerebellar cortex, but their cerebellar cortex, through its innervation of the deep cerebellar nuclei, and then through connected pathways via the thalamus to the prefrontal cortex, could modulate the behavior of these mice during development and in adulthood. So what Peter did was to delete the TSC1 gene under the L7 Cre promoter, which only deletes the gene in the Purkinje cells. These mice are born at the expected frequency. They are relatively healthy, so you can do behavioral testing with the mice. When we looked at the pathology of the brains, in the heterozygous knockouts, there was no change in the number of the Purkinje cells or in their size. However, the non-mutants showed enlargement of cell size in the Purkinje cells and a decrease in cell number. In fact, starting around 6 weeks of life, there was a decrease in Purkinje cell number such that by 4 months, you're only left with a quarter of the Purkinje cells. Then we collaborated with Jackie Crawley and used their three-chamber apparatus to look at the phenotyping of these mice. And what Peter showed was that in the control group, as expected, the animals spent more time interacting with the novel animal compared to the novel object, but our heterozygous or null mutants did not show a preference. Time investigating is shown at the bottom. The controls spend much more time interacting with an animal than the object, and heads and mutants don't show that preference at all. Peter also looked at reversal learning. It is a water T-maze paradigm where you train the animal to learn the platform on one side of the T-maze, and after 3 days of learning, and this is a hippocampal task, after 3 days of learning, you switch the platform, and this is the cerebellar based learning where the animal has to forget the old location and learn the new location. So our mutants did not show any deficits in the hippocampal based part of the task. However, in the second phase, when they have to perform reversal learning, the null mutants show the deficits, and the het mutants show the tendency toward a deficit, but that was not significant statistically. We also collaborated with Wade Regier at Harvard Medical School and recorded from these Purkinje cells, and there was a gene dosage-dependent decrease in the excitability of these mice. So heterozygous Purkinje cells are less excitable than the controls, and the null mutants are even less excitable. We also looked at the axonal and dendritic morphology of these Purkinje cells. So the axons and the mutants show varicosities in the axons and abnormal branching and turning patterns that we never see in the control mice. And if you look at the dendritic spine numbers, you saw that there was an increase in dendritic spine density in the mutant Purkinje cells compared to the control Purkinje cells. There was also an increase in spine length. With these in mind, we decided to do a treatment trial with rifampicin. And Peter treated these mice from P7. And what he showed was that as long as you start the treatment at P7, you can prevent the cell death of the Purkinje cells. And at the same time, there are behavioral improvements. So going back to the social approach test, the three-chamber social approach test, these are the mutants that are treated with the vehicle. They don't show a preference for the animal versus the object. However, the ones that are treated with rifampicin show a striking preference for the animal versus the object, essentially similar to their control litter mates. And in the water T-maze reversal learning paradigm, the deficits that we saw in the vehicle-treated mice was abrogated by rifampicin treatment. So we saw an improvement both in the pathology and the behavioral phenotype of these mice with rifampicin treatment. So everything I've shown you so far in the last couple of slides or last couple of stories is really in mice, and what we're really most concerned about is the patients that we take care of in the clinic. And this is now an old slide from Dan Geschwin, Pat Levitt, but many others, including Nancy Minshew, have made the point that developmental autism spectrum disorder is a developmental disconnection syndrome. There might be abnormal connectivity, either too much connectivity or too little connectivity in between the regions of the brain that are responsible for social interaction and repetitive behaviors, and that might underlie the behavioral phenotype that we see. Now, if this is true, tuberous sclerosis gives us a unique opportunity to test this hypothesis, and as a genetic disorder, the mouse models are congruent with the abnormal connectivity hypothesis of autism spectrum disorder. The advantage we have in tuberous sclerosis is that many of the TSC patients will be diagnosed before birth or at the time of birth because of the presence of these rhabdomyomas in the heart that can be easily seen on an echocardiogram. There's a nice study showing that among fetuses and newborns with multiple cardiac tumors, the chance of having tuberous sclerosis is 95%. So this is a really early and sensitive way to diagnose tuberous sclerosis in utero or neonatally. Now, knowing that we can diagnose tuberous sclerosis early in life, and half of these patients will go on to develop autism spectrum disorder, we've been trying to ask a very simple question. Among the infants born with TSC, can we detect which infants will go on to develop autism? We are using a combination of neurocognitive assessment, diffusion tensor imaging, and neurophysiological assessment. And this is a study that's been going on with Simon Warfield, Jeff Alagesti, and Chuck Nelson for a few years at Boston Children's. And more recently, we've extended it into a consortium, as I'll tell you in a second. Some of the results look quite promising from the early preliminary perspective. So this is a diffusion tensor imaging results from the corpus callosum that we published a few years ago. We compared three cohorts of patients, non-TSC, age-matched controls, TSC patients that are not on the spectrum, and then TSC patients with autism spectrum disorder. And we use a three-dimensional region of interest approach to look at the corpus callosum in these patients. And as you can see visually, these two groups look very similar to each other. And in fact, if you look at the fractional anisotropy, you cannot find any statistical difference between these two groups. However, TSC patients on the spectrum both visually look different on the scans that are shown here, but also have reduced FA. So this gives us an opportunity, I think, within a relatively homogeneous, genetically identified group of patients to determine which ones may be more susceptible to autism risk and which ones may not be. Of course, this is what I'm showing you are relatively old kids. This particular group was from around 5 years of age. The ideal thing would be to be able to do this study at birth and tell a family that their child is at a high risk or a low risk for tuberous sclerosis and potentially treat those two groups quite differently with different treatments. To be able to test this hypothesis and turn it into a potential biomarker, we formed a consortium called the TSC Autism Center of Excellence Research Network. It's composed of 5 hospitals geographically distributed around the country, as shown here. And we're about halfway, well, I guess in terms of recruitment, we're about two-thirds of the way in recruiting 150 infants, and we're about halfway through the study. Of course, being able to identify biomarkers and tell which group is at a high risk and which group is at a low risk is important from a prognostic perspective, but it really only makes a difference if you can do something about the course of the disease. In terms of preclinical studies, mTOR inhibitors look extremely promising. I've shown you that there are improvements in myelination and seizures in the mouse models. Michael Wong's group at WashU developed a different model of tuberous sclerosis using astrocytic knockout of TSC, and he can prevent or stop seizures once they start. Alcina Silva's group did a seminal study where he showed that you can take a mild mouse model of tuberous sclerosis and treat those mice in adults with 5 days of rapamycin, and you can improve the learning disabilities in these mice. And then I showed you the data we've developed, and others, Mike Gambella's group, have also confirmed that you can prevent autistic features in a cerebellar knockout of tuberous sclerosis genes. So with these in mind, a few years ago, we initiated a phase 2 trial of mTOR inhibitors in tuberous sclerosis. We are using Afinitor as the compound that we've already tested in mice, and we're looking at neurocognition as the primary endpoint. We are enrolled patients between 6 and 21 years of age with an IQ greater than 60. We chose that IQ cutoff to be able to do relatively deep phenotyping with neurocognitive measures. It's a randomized placebo-controlled double-blind study. And as Liz said, every open-label trial works, so we've decided to do a placebo-controlled trial. 47 patients from 2 sites were enrolled, from Cincinnati and Boston. We did neurocognitive testing at baseline, 3 months, and 6 months. And secondary endpoints were autism spectrum disorder as measured by ADAS-ADI-SRS, seizures, and sleep disorders, because sleep is a major morbidity associated with this disease. The study actually was finished in December of 2014. We've locked the database, and we're in the process of analyzing the data, and hopefully in a few months we'll have all the data analyzed. Now, the issue that I think many of us raised during this symposium is that there are a large number of genes that are associated with autism spectrum disorder. Our hope is that some of the rare diseases that have high penetrance of autism will give us some inroads into subcategories of convergent pathways in autism spectrum disorder. And our hope is that tuberous sclerosis disease will be one of these subcategories that will give us insights into the underlying biochemistry and genetics of autism spectrum disorder. That might allow us to then try the same drug in that enlarged number of genetic deficits that we see in the patients. So as a part of that, we've decided to form a developmental synaptopathies consortium and focus on 3 genes that we think might be implicated in the same genetic, same biochemical pathway. These are TSC1 and 2, P10, and SHANK3 mutations. And this was funded by the NIH, by 4 different institutes at the NIH. It's called the Developmental Synaptopathies Consortium. And I think every one of the speakers that are talking in this session are all members of this consortium. And we're going to do natural history studies of these 3 diseases, as well as a clinical pilot treatment trial in P10 patients with an mTOR inhibitor. Now, these are all clinical studies, and we wanted to complement them with preclinical studies, and Autism Speaks actually, even before the clinical study, had the insight to initiate a preclinical autism consortium for therapeutics called PACT. This is based at UC Davis, Vanderbilt, and Boston Children's, and the idea is to de-risk target selection and encourage investment in ASD medications going forward, with including the pharma industry. So we are looking at the mouse models as well as rat models of several different genes that are, and the first cohort of genes are shown here, and to look at both behavioral abnormalities as well as neurophysiological abnormalities in these mice to prepare a preclinical package to get pharma interested in these diseases. So I think that both the clinical data as well as preclinical data that we're going to get by comparative analysis of these disorders will be extremely helpful going forward. So I'd like to stop here and acknowledge the people that did the work. Peter Tsai, who's in the audience, now he has his own lab at UT Southwestern, and the work on myelination was done by Ebru Arjan. And we have many, many collaborators that without whom this work would not be possible and our funding sources. Thank you very much.